Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, a national liberal arts college and conservatory, offering an engaging global education with funding for internships, research, study abroad, and more. Lawrence.edu. Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, from artists to scientists, we'll take a look at the roots of creative genius.
First, you have probably noticed that the mosquitoes have been pretty bad this summer in Wisconsin. Well, I've got some news for you. The ticks have been pretty bad, too. And here with a summer update on ticks is Wisconsin Public Radio's Rich Kramer, based in Eau Claire. Welcome, Rich.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we've heard some reports that show the Eau Claire area is a hot spot for ticks this season. What's going on up there?
Well, a lot of people don't know why. And Eau Claire and western Wisconsin has been a hot spot for a long time for ticks, as far as actually for tick-borne diseases. Nobody really goes out and counts ticks per square miles, per square foot, or anything like that. But what they do measure are reportable illnesses, such as your Lyme disease, you've got ehrlichiosis, anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and a couple others. But this year, there are some investigations. There's a study going on in Eau Claire County to try to get a handle on what percentage of ticks have the bacteria that is responsible for Lyme disease. That's going on right now. But in the past, Eau Claire County has been a hotspot in terms of the number of people with Lyme disease reported. The CDC says that Eau Claire County has more cases than any other county in the state.
Yeah, sort of a dubious distinction there. And As I understand it, there is, and you're going to have to pronounce this for me because I just can't do it, there's a new disease that has shown up this year that people are concerned about.
Well, it actually doesn't have a name.
That's good. I could pronounce that.
But the researchers are calling it Ehrlichia muris-like. The reason being is Ehrlichia muris is a tick-borne disease that, or a strain of Ehrlichia, which is a family of bacteria, that is found more often in European and Asian countries. But since 2009, it's been popping up here. Eau Claire County had one of the first cases, it's believed, that was reported anyway. That was back in 2009. Since then, statewide, there have only been 28 cases, 8 of them in Eau Claire County. But the people I talked to said that they expect it to keep increasing because basically more people are testing for it, and now they know how to find it.
Yeah, 28 cases. I'm not sure I would know if I had it. What are the symptoms?
Well, it's kind of like Lyme disease. You've got it's fever. It feels like a flu-like symptoms. Headache, fever, chills, muscle aches, nausea, vomiting. But then if it's untreated, it can get pretty nasty. It goes after the internal organs and starts deteriorating them. But with a lot of these, like with a lot of these tick-borne diseases, simple antibiotics are used to treat it. And doctors are actually being told to treat first, even before they know what it is, because these kind of diseases are becoming more common.
Do we know what kind of ticks carry these? Are these wood ticks or just deer ticks? Or?
Well, they're called the black-legged ticks, what we call wood ticks. Yes, okay. Those are the vectors.
All right, very good. It sounds like something to keep my eyes open for and be careful when I'm out in the woods.
Luckily, all you have to do is basic tick prevention. You know, use some repellents. Permethrin is another product you can use on your clothes. Tuck your shirts into your pants and your pants into your socks. You should be good.
Okay, either that or I'll just hide here under my desk.
You can
Rich,
do that too.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's WPR reporter Rich Kramer, and he is based in Eau Claire. The line between mental illness and genius has been a point of fascination for scientists for the last couple of centuries, and it continues to intrigue them today.
Mental illness and mood disorders have been evident in a wide spectrum of creative geniuses and their close relatives, from scientists like Albert Einstein to writers like James Joyce and Sylvia Plath.
But are these high-profile cases special exceptions, or do they indicate a clear link between creative genius and mental illness? It's a question that our next guest is trying to answer.
Dr. Nancy Andreasen joins us now. She's the Andrew H. Woods Chair of Psychiatry and Director of the Iowa Neuroimaging Consortium at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. She's written a piece, a cover story in The Atlantic, called Secrets of the Creative Brain. Dr. Andreasen, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
So first of all, how do we classify a creative genius? How do we define someone as highly creative?
Well, there are two perspectives on how to do that. One, which is the one that I use, is called the case study method. And with that approach, you just identify people who have been very highly successful, highly recognized, highly rewarded. In the study that I'm doing, most of the people have gotten things like Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, National Medal of Science or Technology, big Academy Award winners. So you identify people that I think almost anybody would say is highly creative, and then you go ahead and study them. The other approach is one that's called a psychometric approach, and that is done by giving people tests that tap into creativity. And the trait that people are trying to get at is something called divergent thinking, or the ability to come up with a whole lot of responses to an open-ended probe. A common example is asking them to think of how many uses can you think of for a brick? And an answer would be, well, for paving, for a floor in a house, for a bookend, for something you can throw at somebody, and so on. You know, you can think of all different kinds of things. And those answers are graded in terms of originality and fluency. And then the people in the top 1% on divergent thinking are considered to have the trait of creativity. So they're very different approaches. That is the more psychometric approach. And then the other one is the case study approach.
And why are you interested in checking out this possible link between creative genius and mental illness?
Well, I've been interested in that because for a long time. My original career was actually as an English lit professor, and I taught here at the University of Iowa for 3 years and a couple of years at the University of Nebraska. So 5 years as an English professor teaching Renaissance English Lit. And as a person with a career in literature, I was very aware of people who either themselves had had, were creative and had had some kind of mental illness. Someone like Byron, Joyce certainly had some odd traits, and who also had mental illness in their families. Joyce had a daughter with schizophrenia. Einstein had a son with schizophrenia. Bertrand Russell had a son with schizophrenia. And so I thought, well, you know, most of my work involves studying people with serious mental illnesses, but wouldn't it be interesting and fun to look at the question of whether, you know, creativity and mental illness are related? And to be truthful, when I began the study, I did not expect to find very much illness in the group that I studied, which was a sample that was very handy. The people who were teaching writing fellows or faculty members at the Iowa Writers Workshop, which is easily the most famous writing program in the U.S. and probably in the world. So I had a nice, interesting sample that was very handy.
And I think at one point that included Kurt Vonnegut.
Yes, it did. It included a number of very well-known people. And it's funny because everybody loves Kurt Vonnegut. He's probably the most famous of the people who were in the study. And I like him very much, too. He's, of course, no longer with us, but he was a very nice and very interesting person, and we stayed in touch after he was a subject in the study. And even, he would send me notes and even a couple of love poems. So,
Well, and now you've got these creative people, these writers. How do you measure their creativity, try to associate it with possible mental illness or mental illness-like symptoms?
Well, so I have these people, and the intent of the original study was to interview them. And the working hypothesis was that they weren't necessarily going to have a mental illness, but that they would have mental illness in their families, as, say, Joyce did and Bertrand Russell did, and that that illness would be schizophrenia. And then I was also interested in whether any of their family members had have been highly creative. And so that study was very simple. I contacted them, told them about the study, and they agreed to come in and be interviewed. And typically the interviews lasted for 3 or 4 hours, much to my surprise, because I didn't expect them to stay in my office and talk that long. Once they got there, they just wanted to, you know, they're literary people, good with words, and they wanted to tell me all about themselves and their lives and their families. And what emerged was that they turned out, the writers themselves, to have a high rate of basically mood disorder, depression. Some of them had bipolar disorder, but that was not as common. Bipolar disorder is having both highs and lows. I think it's very important to point out at this point, by the way, that when I say they had a high rate of mood disorder, that does not mean that they were depressed all the time throughout their lives or that they were chronically ill, because they weren't. I mean, the majority of the time, they were perfectly normal, and that's the way mood disorder is. People who have depression, most of them, you know, I guarantee you that if you have 10 to 20 people around you, at least 30-40% of them will have had a depression at some time in their lives. I mean, it's just a very common illness. And so, anyway, these writers had a rate actually of 80% in terms of what we call lifetime prevalence or occurrence of a mood disorder in their lifetime. And I had a comparison group of people whom I did not know to be highly creative. And I looked at the rate of mood disorder in them. Their rate was actually 30% using the criteria that I used. So the writers, you know, had a, you know, statistically significant difference in rate of mood disorder from the controls. And there was more mood disorder in their families than in the controls. And there was more creativity in their families than in the controls.
We're talking with psychiatrist Dr. Nancy Andreasen about the secrets of the creative brain. We'll take the next step in a few moments and ask what the connection between those mood disorders and creativity might have been.
And we'd like to hear from you, too. What questions do you have about that possible connection, that relationship that might exist between creative genius and mental illness? And what about these research findings intrigue you or perhaps surprise you? Let us know at 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation now with Dr. Nancy Andreasen about the secrets of the creative brain. And we'd like to hear from you.
Do you have questions about possible connections between creativity and mental illness, things like mood disorders? Why do you suppose there would be a link? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Dr. Andreasen, you said a higher than expected incidence of lifetime mood disorders among your group of creatives. So what is the connection? Is there something about doing creative things that leads to mood disorders or vice versa? How do you tease that out?
Well, the way I think about it is that certainly mood disorders do not cause creativity. I think that's a real fallacy to think that way, that you have to have a mental illness in order to be creative. The other direction, that if you're creative, you're going to have a mental illness, that isn't necessarily true either. What I think happens is that there's a certain way of approaching life, a personality style, a cognitive style, that characterizes creative people, writers, and other creative people, which is being adventuresome, exploratory, testing the limits, being somewhat unconventional. And when you're like that, you're more prone to, so to speak, maybe slip over the edge. but not necessarily. I want to make that very clear. Mm-hmm. And you're more prone to potentially be rejected by peers, by people who are evaluating your work because it's too original. And so you have to deal with rejection, which always hurts, whether, you know, you're a writer or a skier or, a, you know, whatever. And the thing about creative people is that they tend, they're also very persistent. So even though they get rejected, they keep on going. And I actually tend to think of the metaphor as a prize fighter who gets knocked down but keeps getting up and going back to the fight again.
So this spirit of creative adventurousness, I think you called it, makes us more prone to coming up with valuable creative output and also somewhat more likely to have a mood disorder. Not 100% either way, just a little more likely in both of those directions.
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's go to our callers. We've got Sean on the line in Kenosha. Sean, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a general comment. I suppose throw my two cents into it. But I personally am someone who has depression. I have never felt to be extraordinarily creative. But I have a relative who he spends a lot of time writing, and he is very creative. I have never felt that he was someone who had depressive episodes or mood disorders. But I felt that most of his writing has been bland at best. So, and then also on my mother, she is someone who has depression, probably is bipolar, and she is someone who is extremely creative and inventive. She loves to do home decor, and she used to be an artist when she was younger.
Sean, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Dr. Andreasen, does creativity and things like mood disorders, do they both tend to run in families like that?
Yes, they do. I mean, putting creativity to the side, mood disorders run in families. And putting mood disorders to the side, creativity tends to run in families. I would say mood disorder is more familial than creativity. But anyway, they both have certainly a kind of nature, if you think about nature versus nurture, a kind of nature component to them. It's not anything like 100%. It's, you know, more in probably the 20% range. But it's there.
I know part of your study in your research into mental illness and creativity is also geared toward finding out what creativity is, how it happens. I know you've put creative people in MRI machines. What kind of things have you discovered about creativity that way?
Well, there's a lot to be said about how creativity happens. The MR studies we designed are looking, the idea was to look at tasks that would stimulate the process of making connections or making associations, because the ability to make novel connections is, I think, a very key part of the creative process. And what we found looking at, this is a new study now, it's one that's ongoing, it's looking at both artists and scientists, and what we found is that the creative people in the study have more intense activations in the regions of the brain that are used to make associations. We call it the association cortex or cortices, because there are, you know, four or five of them in the human brain. So that's one of the things that we found that characterizes creative people.
And outside of the MRI study, I loved one thing you wrote about. We have a stereotype, whether it's an artist or a scientist having their aha or their eureka moment where they make those connections you were just talking about. But that's not where the creativity starts, is it?
No, it sure isn't. In this article in Atlantic Magazine, I talk about how creativity is really a process. It starts with preparation. And people are doing that preparation when they're going to school. I mean, in grade school, high school, college, and so on, they're acquiring knowledge, experiences that they're going to use later on to do something creative. And then there's a period called incubation where ideas bounce around and, you know, the information that's been gained is kind of nebulous and unformed, and then depending on, of course, the kind of creativity, but the key connection is made, the eureka moment occurs, But that's not the end of it. If you have all kinds of original ideas and you don't execute them, if you don't, you know, complete the process, you're not creative.
1% inspiration, 99% perspiration.
Yep, Thomas Edison.
All right. Well, Dr. Andreasen, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your research with us.
Oh, thank you very much. By the way, I love Wisconsin. My daughter did her PhD there.
Well, good for her. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks so much for coming back to Wisconsin via radio. That was Dr. Nancy Andreasen. She's the author of the latest cover story in The Atlantic. It's called Secrets of the Creative Brain, looking at the link between creative genius and mental illness.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time in our Food Friday segment, Lori Skelton has some different variations of a summer picnic classic, the potato salad.
First, yesterday, Governor Walker asked the state legislature to repeal the state's Common Core educational standards at the start of the next legislative session in January.
Although a bill in the state assembly aimed at repealing those standards failed last session, activists around the state and some Republicans in the legislature have continued to call for those standards to be repealed.
Here with us now to talk about his response to Governor Walker's call is State Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt from Fond du Lac. He is the author of the assembly bill that failed last year, which was aimed at repealing the Common Core standards. Representative Thiesfeldt, welcome to Central Time.
Hi. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Well, obviously, you're pleased by the governor's decision. Were you surprised by it?
Well, I guess, no, I wouldn't say I was surprised by it, because it seems that that is the direction things are heading nationwide. You can hardly go a week now without some sort of news coming up about another state that is taking measures against the implementation of Common Core. And Wisconsin started looking at it last year, although the bill that I put forward at the time last year, along with a few other legislators, was not directly seeking a repeal of the Common Core standards. It certainly was interested in the process of putting standards together in Wisconsin. That got a lot of attention, which is a good thing. And I think that rather than calming the issue down, the opposition to it has only intensified since that time.
So tell me how you came to oppose the Common Core standards and what your thinking on that is.
Well, I spent almost 22 years in a classroom before I got in the legislature. And so I'm pretty well versed in what standards are all about. And if you hear some background noise, that's because I'm at the Fond du Lac County Fair right now.
Okay, we'll keep that in mind.
But after my 22 years of teaching and I got into the legislature, I started hearing more and more from people about these Common Core standards that were coming down the line. And after some investigation on my own, I decided it was time for us to take a closer look at these standards in the state of Wisconsin, and was able to be appointed to the special committee that was formed in the assembly last year. And we held hearings around the state and put out some resolutions that we wanted to see a process in Wisconsin where all of our academic standards would be studied on a periodic basis. In other words, put it on a schedule, because I think most people would find it hard to believe that we don't have something like that already, but we don't. And that was really the bill that was rejected, was the periodic review of the standards. And what the governor called for yesterday goes beyond that. He called for a full repeal, which, you know, I think that is the right direction to take. The time frame for doing this has become much shorter than if we had started action on it last spring already. And so that makes it more challenging to try to get something else in place in time. But I do believe that it is the appropriate direction for our state to take to have our own set of standards. And not something that is driven out of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that because that's one of the issues that has come up. If you're going to repeal something, obviously it would have to be replaced with something else, and you mentioned that time factor there. Talk about the time factor a little bit and talk about what you would see as a process for replacing these. Who should be at the table? Who should be having these discussions?
Well, clearly you're not going to see legislators putting together standards for the schools. That should be done by people who are directly involved in the schools. Certainly the Department of Public Instruction needs to play a role in that. But ultimately, the legislature does have a say, just like they do on anything else that takes place in the state of Wisconsin where taxpayer dollars are spent. And so that is kind of the direction we need to take on it. I would be completely comfortable with the bill that we tried to get passed last session. I think that was a very measured response. But I think that the direction the citizens of Wisconsin are headed on this is that they want to see these standards. They're tired of the talk of studying them. They want to see them repealed. And as for what to put in its place, you know, we've been using standards in Wisconsin currently. Common Core standards are only math and English language arts, which encompasses a couple different courses. But it's mostly math and English. And if we had to continue using what we've been doing for the last few years in the interim until we got something else into place, that would be fine. It would be fine if we went back to the previous math and English standards that we've been using in Wisconsin. But ultimately, this is a direction we need to head because I believe that the state of Wisconsin is best served by standards that are put together by and for specifically students in the state of Wisconsin.
Heard from some of your colleagues in the news this afternoon, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald saying that developing new standards now will be very difficult. It sounds like he's willing to take a look at it, but doesn't sound particularly enthusiastic yet. Heard a comment from Senator Luther Olson, who is the chair of the Education Committee on the Senate side, saying that he is not for this review either. It sounds as though that even though the governor is calling for something, that there's still a lot that's going to be a battle in the legislature.
Well, that shouldn't be surprising. It's an important issue. And we knew it was going to be a battle last time, and it's a battle all over the country. But where I do believe that we are looking at the future independence of our schools in the state of Wisconsin. Do we want schools that are essentially driven by standards that are coming out of Washington, D.C., because as we know, it's pretty hard to dispute the fact that anytime you're going to allow involvement coming out of Washington, D.C., that involvement only grows over time. It doesn't get less. And so we have to understand that that is what's going to take place. I think that we know better here in Wisconsin. We have plenty of sharp people in place who can come up with a good, solid set of standards that aren't going to be tied down by the Department of Education in Washington, D.C.
Now, as you look ahead to the January session, what are you going to be doing between now and then to try to build support for this? I mean, it's a long way, and there's an election in the middle here, so there's a lot of other things going on. Is this just going to get lost in the shuffle?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that one of the problems that we've had in schools, not only in Wisconsin but across the nation, is that less and less, we have not had parental involvement in our schools. You think back 30, 20, 25, 30 years ago, even beyond that, parents were directly involved in almost every aspect of our schools, and that is not so much the case anymore. And so what was unusual about this whole process nationwide is that this has been driven by parents who have stood up and said, we are concerned about this, we don't like the direction it's headed, and we want it to be changed. And those citizens, just common everyday people who are taking control of their schools and their children's education, they are the ones who have brought this to the legislators and said, and pressured them to say, you know, we got to do something about this, and the legislators have responded. You know, that's what we're supposed to do, is respond to what people say, and I believe, after my studies and my years of experience, that there is a better direction to go on this.
Well, Representative, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here. Have a good day.
Yeah, and enjoy the fair. We've been speaking with Assembly Representative Jeremy Thiesfeldt from Fond du Lac. During the last legislative session, he authored a bill aimed at reviewing the state's Common Core standards. And yesterday, Governor Walker called on the state legislature to repeal those standards. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Summer is full of barbecues and picnics, and that usually includes some classic dishes, including potato salad. And by the way, the humble potato salad has gotten some headlines lately after a Kickstarter campaign crowdfunded about $50,000 in pledges to make a batch of this stuff.
Man, for $50,000, I would have made a batch
of
this stuff. Well, we've got good news because we've got lots of potato salad in the studio. Lori Skelton is with us right now, and we're going to be talking about some of the different iterations of this classic dish, and we don't even have a Kickstarter campaign here.
No.
Lori is one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back to Central Time.
Now, I've got to give one caveat. We decided to do a show on potato salad today when the Kickstarter campaign was only at $5,000.
Wow.
So we were ahead of the curve.
Well, here's the thing. Of all the Food Friday segments that I've looked into, this had to have been the most contentious. I didn't post a recipe today. I posted some suggestions.
Ah, okay.
But there is no one way to make potato salad.
So if you want to start a fight, start talking potato salad.
I mean... Don't even get me started on the do you use mayonnaise or Miracle Whip. When I met the woman who insists on half and half, it's like, okay, we're just. And for me, potato salad is something really special. My mother makes a basic American potato salad. She doesn't add a lot to it. I have actually stood next to her in the kitchen, duplicated her movements, potato by mayonnaise, by egg, and I can never get my potato salad to taste like my mother's. Mm. It's the one thing she can just throw it together. It's perfect every time. I try to write down a recipe, and I just flop.
And as you say, there are lots of variations on this. We were talking before, and you kind of call potato salad a blank canvas.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
Besides the fact that everybody has their own way of doing it, you're working with a starch. So you've got something that can take on so many different flavors. If you want it hotter, people suggested sriracha or jalapenos. If you want it milder, you up the amount of mayonnaise you're using, or you use something like sour cream in your basic American potato salad. And then, of course, you've got things like German potato salad, which is incredibly popular
German
in Wisconsin.
Mm.
This is a potato salad that should be served hot. Unlike American potato salad, which you can pull right out of the refrigerator, this you really have to put together at the last minute. But it's such a marvelous accompaniment, especially if you decide to play around with the vinaigrette, maybe omit the bacon or use less because you know you're going to be serving it alongside certain sausage products that maybe don't need it.
Now, Lori, we'll get to the samples you brought in just a minute. A lot of times lately you've thrown in some secret ingredients into things like miso and dessert. This time the secret ingredient is just potato.
Because I use three different kinds of potato for the three different kinds of salads we've got.
Ooh.
For the basic American salad, I discovered that especially if you're wanting to watch your weight, you'll want to use a little less mayonnaise, but you still want a creamy potato salad. So use a russet potato. These are going to cook up a little bit mealier. They'll actually fall apart as you're blending the salad together, so that will add to the creaminess without adding to the calories.
They soak up the water kind of as you boil them and really get it into the starch there. It seems
exactly.
Like.
Another thing that I discovered in putting these together, it does help if whatever potato you're using, season the water. Put in salt if you're good with salt in your diet. If not, use something like a little bit of sliced onion or a bay leaf. Seasoning the potatoes while they're cooking will actually make them taste better in the salad. So that's the American potato salad. I used russets there. For the German potato salad, I wanted a potato that I could peel, but something that would have a little more stability to it, a little lower on the starch. So here I used a gold Yukon gold potatoes, excuse me, they're called. For the French potato salad, I wanted a little bit of color, and I also wanted to leave the skin on, and there I used a red potato.
Okay. Well, we've been smelling these for some time now, actually. So let's start tasting. Do you want to start American? I'm holding the American here, right?
And I threw in a little bit more than I normally do with a potato salad for American. We've got celery and celery seed in here, dry mustard powder.
Kind of tastes like my mom's.
Little bit of chopped mm-hmm. onion, little bit of pickle relish, and a little bit of egg. What my mother does is she uses a lot more egg than I do. She also uses chopped fresh green pepper rather than celery. But I know somebody who insists it's American potato salad, even though he puts in chopped French pickles and capers.
I could see pickles in this, definitely. So I would say, I mean, looking at this and tasting it, this, if I just thought potato salad, this is what pops into my head. I think the celery, I love it in potato salad. It's got to be a key.
As I'm trying not to crunch into the microphone.
Right, that's fine. Crunch away. there's a little bit of zippiness. Is that just, I mean, a tiny bit. Is that just pepper or?
I always use fresh ground pepper.
Okay.
And maybe that's what you're catching.
I think that's
But I did use 3/4 teaspoon of dry mustard powder.
Mm.
So it's not bland. It's not going to blow your ears off, but there is a little bit of a kick to it. What do you think about the creaminess factor? I only used 1/2 cup of mayonnaise in this.
I like
Gene
creaminess.
Wants more creaminess.
I do want more creaminess, but this is very good. This is very good. There's always room for more mayonnaise for me.
I would probably throw in more mayo too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really good. The
mm-hmm.
taste is awesome. For me, I would put in a little more mayo.
But
you're thinking, hey, I want to watch my weight. I don't want so much mayonnaise in there. And that makes sense.
So what
sour cream? Would you do that ever?
I have. It's probably not my favorite. For me, that makes it just a tad too fancy.
Too fancy for you, Laura.
Too uptown for you, my goodness.
There are certain things you just don't want to get too snooty about. And for me, potato salad is one of them. Like I say, I have such a strong sense memory of when my mother makes potato salad. I don't want to screw it up. And the more I do to it, the more it doesn't taste like hers.
You know, and what this really reminds me of, this is great for like food on a hot day.
Yes.
It really is. It's really good that way. So, but I'm holding now what we really all came here for, and that's the German potato salad.
Yes, you told me this is your favorite.
Oh my gosh, is it my favorite?
Now the problem with what I had to do today is I wasn't able to actually combine all of this in a pan on the stove. I mean, this is really something you have to make at the last minute. So I cheated a little. I made the potatoes. I made the vinaigrette, which is after you've fried up your bacon, you take the bacon out and then you've got all those lovely little crispy bits in the pan.
Yep.
You throw in some onion and then you throw in some of the potato water from when the potatoes were cooking and a little bit of vinegar and a little bit of sugar and you cook that all down. And you're supposed to throw the potatoes in and let that all talk to itself. I had to do it separately in the microwave. What do you think, Gene?
Well, this is my new favorite. I love the little bacon stuff. I love everything about it.
Okay.
And are these are the onions here, right?
There are some onions in there.
It almost looks like sauerkraut.
And I did use some German stone ground mustard with just a little bit of horseradish.
Oh, boy.
Really good. Really good. What's the vinegar in here?
Just basic white vinegar. Nothing fancy. I saved the fancy for the next potato salad we're going to have.
For France land.
For France. Absolutely. Judiciaire's Poisson has been schooling me in how to make a good French vinaigrette, so I've been practicing with some of her suggestions.
Not to offend her, it's going to be hard to top the German. This is
salad is so unbelievably good. How are you going to top it with this French salad we've got here?
Well, with the American potato salad, you're going to want that fairly cold. German potato salad, hot right off the stove. The French potato salad, you can serve room temperature and not worry about it. This is a potato that is sliced rather than diced up. So you've got a fair amount of potato surface area. And when the potatoes come out of the water, you spread them out on a baking sheet and you pour vinaigrette over them. Use Dijon mustard and champagne vinegar. Again, a little bit of the potato water that the potatoes cooked in. It's got some starch into it, so that's going to give the vinaigrette some body. There is parsley, tarragon, and chives. If I had chervil, I would have used it. That's a lovely French herb, but I bumped up the tarragon and the parsley with this. There's also some chopped shallot and a little bit of garlic.
Well, go ahead.
Seems like there'd be room to play around with fresh herbs on this one. I could see making it distinctly different just by changing the fresh herbs.
And another thing that you can do if you want to play around with more green is use blanched green beans with this as well. That is going to be something that will play with a lot of different herbs. You could use thyme with that or savory. It's not exactly a straight French potato salad, but I know a lot of people do like having that crunch. And that's one thing you're missing with a French vinaigrette potato salad, is something a little bit toothy.
Well, I think more celebrations in order in Germany on top of their big World Cup win. I think they win the Central Time Potato Salad Cup as well. I like all of them a lot, but I think the German has got to be my favorite of the batch. Gene?
And mine too. I have to say we had a lot of worthy competition here today, and they were all excellent in their own way, so kudos to them. But I'm just a German potato salad fan, and so that's my starting point is there. And you really came through today. They were terrific.
Lori, just in our little bit of time left, any other last recommendations to experiment with on our potato salad, or a personal favorite?
Again, to play around with your basic potato salad, start with your potatoes. Figure out which one is going to be the best for your particular salad. One thing I didn't try, there are some wonderful colored potatoes out there, red and purple. And I know some people for 4th of July will actually take small red, white, and purple or blue potatoes and make their potato salad that way. Play around with how you season the water. And one thing, as we're talking about blank canvas, that I might want to suggest you try is upping the heat a little bit.
Okay. Well, sounds great. Lori, these are awesome. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Absolutely.
That's Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies at WPR.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.